This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Later in the hour, we'll be talking about a new planet, a mysterious planet far out in our solar system. But first, the crew of the International Space Station, a little closer to home, woke up to a pleasant surprise last weekend, a bouquet of fresh flowers grown right there in their space garden. Astronaut and gardener Scott Kelly proudly shared a photo of the bright orange zinnia bloom. But these were not the first flowers to bloom in space. Here with more about what it takes to grow flowers in zero-G, as well as other selected short subjects in science, is Rachel Feltman. She writes for the Speaking of Science blog at the Washington Post. Good to see you again, Rachel.
Good to see you too, Ira.
Tell us about these flowers.
Right. So Scott Kelly was able to bloom some zinnias in the same apparatus that the astronauts have used to grow lettuce now a couple of times, which they've actually eaten. And it's all part of NASA's initiative to learn how to grow vegetables in space, ideally so that astronauts have a source of fresh food in long-term spaceflight, like with missions to Mars. And it's not the first flower to bloom in space. It's not even the first flower grown entirely in space. That was probably done on the pre-ISS Russian spacecrafts.
And we also had Don Pettit, who was
he brought up broccoli
he grew in space. Mm-hmm.
He brought up seeds he had germinated in little plastic baggies and actually grew a sunflower, though it didn't do very well. Kelly was working with this apparatus that's designed to, you know, keep plants properly moistened and, you know, anchored in the soil, even in low gravity. And it's very complicated. It's easy for them to get overwatered, and there was a lot of, you know, rot happening. And he actually asked the mission team if he could just decide when to water the plants. He said, you know, if I was working on a garden at home, I would look at it every day and decide what it needed. So they gave him more free rein. And sure enough, he was able to nurse the flowers back to health. And we have a bloom.
He had a greener thumb than NASA.
Yes. And it's actually great because it shows that, you know, an astronaut working with the plants is probably going to do a pretty decent job of taking care of them. And I think the hope is that they'll move on to more traditionally edible flowering plants like tomatoes,
right,
and just keep working on increasingly complicated stuff.
Yeah. Next up, a really troubling story about PCBs. They were banned worldwide in 1986, but they're showing up again.
Yeah, so polychlorinated biphenyls were invented in the 20s and were, you know, this great technological marvel. They have a lot of applications in plastics and as cooling liquids for transformers and electronics. And the thing is that they really don't break down, and they've been shown to have a lot of toxic effects across the board for all kinds of animals, including humans. So they've been banned for a long time now, and a lot of cleanup efforts have been made, but they are not water-soluble, so they tend to get stuck to sediment and get kicked back up in the water. So these researchers examined whales in Europe and found that killer whales, bottlenose dolphins, and striped dolphins had some of the highest ever concentrations of PCBs recorded. The reason it's so dangerous for marine mammals like whales is that because the PCBs are fat soluble, they build up in fatty tissues like blubber over time. Because whales live so long, they have lots of time to accumulate them. And because they're so high on the food chain, they eat lots of other organisms that have PCBs in them. Mm-hmm. So basically, the whales have it particularly bad. And the concern is that if whale populations are suffering for other reasons, having high levels of PCBs in their system is not going to help them recover. So the concern is that there are certain groups that might even go extinct.
There's no danger that it's in the fish that we eat, the kinds of fish?
Well, you know, that would be something they would have to look at specifically.
Yeah.
You know, any animal that has a lot of fatty tissue and is in an area that's contaminated with PCBs is probably not something you want to eat.
Now, let's talk about the world's longest prime number. How many times are we going to hear another story about a longer prime number?
An infinite number of times.
Good one.
Yeah. So the University of Central Missouri is now responsible for its fourth record-breaking prime number. It's 22 million digits long, which is 5 million digits longer than the last record breaker. And it came from this computer software from the Great Internet Mersenne Prime project. Basically, any computer can run it in the background. And the only way to find prime numbers at this magnitude is you just go through every number and check if it's prime. So the University of Central Missouri contributes the most computing time of anyone to this project. So sure enough, they keep finding winners.
Yeah, and they'll keep repeating this unlike a prime number.
Until yes.
I had to get that one in there. I was thinking about this. Does a number exist if it's not written down? I mean, it's a number.
Right. Well, that's an interesting point because the computer found this number in September, but there was a malfunction and it didn't alert anyone. So people only saw it in January. So the question is, when was the number discovered? Because obviously numbers always exist, but does that count if a human didn't observe it? You know, if a tree falls in the woods, if a
right.
prime number.
My thought exactly. You know, are we just talking about concepts? Numbers,
right.
They don't
it's
exist until we write them or think
them. Pretty mind-boggling stuff.
Yeah. Well, my brain is hurting. let's move on to something my brain can get around, and that's the Venus flytrap. I had one as a kid. Doesn't everybody have one as a kid?
Yeah. They're really cool and really weird, and they just got weirder. Researchers found that flytraps can kind of count in a weird way. They're not really sure how this happens. Obviously, Venus flytraps don't have brains. But they found that the plant can basically keep track of how many times it's touched. When they touch the Venus flytrap once, nothing happens, but it's like a clock starts. And if it's touched again within a certain number of seconds, then it traps the thing that's touching it, but only partially. It waits for a third touch before it closes all the way. And then it's not until the fifth touch that it starts releasing digestive enzymes and releases more and more based on how many more times it's touched. And it's really ingenious because that's allowing it to not waste its time on things that are dead that fall into it, on things that brush past it that it's not going to be able to capture. And it also allows the plant to, you know, really be in charge of how much energy it's expending. So a really lively big bug is going to touch it more and is going to get more digestive enzyme. So they really have no idea how it manages this, but
how does it count, basically?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, they're going to sequence its genome and try to figure out, you know, kind of what electrical impulses are making this happen.
Wow. That's it. You know, the more we learn about plants, the more fascinating. They are. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Rachel Feltman writes for the Speaking of Science blog at the Washington Post. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And while many eyes are focused on politics, the real action is occurring in Florida. Last week marked the start of an unusual contest in the Sunshine State, the 2016 Python Challenge Burmese Python Removal Competition. That's right, for an entry fee of $25, you too can sign up to help rid the Everglades of pythons. Joining me with the good and the bad and the huh of this hunt is Craig Pittman. He's a reporter covering environmental issues for the Tampa Bay Times. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks.
Tell us about this. What's good about this? Why have a python roundup? I mean, we're going after wild creatures.
Well, you mean besides that it's more interesting than the presidential race? I guess the big thing is that pythons are sort of the ultimate example of an invasive species. Florida has more invasive species than any other state, and this is the poster child for it. And so the State Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission is holding this python challenge to raise awareness of the invasive species problem and also get rid of a few of the thousands and thousands of pythons that are infesting the Everglades.
Well, tell us about what danger do they pose?
They are voracious eating machines. Scientists have found that everywhere there are pythons, they pretty much wipe out everything else. They found that between 2003 and 2011, the areas where the pythons had proliferated saw a 99% decrease in raccoons, a 98% drop in possums, 94% drop in white-tailed deer, 87% drop in bobcats, and no rabbits or foxes, period.
Wow. And so, and they're spreading.
Yes. Oh. Yes, they are. There was a captive breeding experiment involving endangered rats, believe it or not, down in the Florida Keys, where they released some of the captive bred rats with little radio monitors, and one researcher tracking one of the rats discovered the radio monitor was broadcasting from inside a python, which was their first clue that the pythons can swim.
So how many pythons can they hope to eliminate? I mean, there got to be thousands of them. How many? What percentage can they get?
Well, let's put it this way. They had one of these in 2013 and captured all of 68. As of today, they have caught 39. So that's an amount that one female python could pretty much replicate with one clutch of eggs.
So this is really sort of futile. We're talking about
the scientists like it though,
yeah,
because it gets them a lot of new information. For instance, they said that the pythons captured in the 2013 hunt showed them some different information as far as the diet that they're eating. So that's been helpful.
So what could be the bad thing about this?
That some people might think this is the be all end all answer to getting rid of the pythons, when in fact it's just, you know, a drop in the bucket, really. And the thing is, the people in charge acknowledge that. They say, look, we know this isn't going to eliminate the problem. We're just, you know, we're trying to do this as one way to get some of the pythons out of the Everglades.
I understand there are animal rights concerns here.
Well, it's interesting. Yes, the people for the ethical treatment of animals sent a very sternly worded letter to the Wildlife Commission and said, please don't let the hunters decapitate the pythons with machetes, because then they writhe around in agony for a while. Now, you might think PETA would then say, please save the pythons, but no, not even PETA likes pythons. They said, instead, have them blow their heads off with guns. That's a better way to kill them.
How many shots, you know, with a writhing python, how many shots is it going to take, and how much ricocheting is there going to be? How many people are going to get hurt from
the
buckshot?
Well, that's a good question. Well, you know, in Florida, we are the gunshine state. But the guy who is the most successful python hunter in Florida history is a great-grandfather with a shotgun, who is employed by one of our state agencies to go around. He says he can actually smell the pythons. They're sort of musky odor, and he's killed more than 300 of them personally.
Wow. He's a one-man python army.
He is.
A few more of him, and you won't get more than, three dozen pythons.
I suggested cloning a guy. I mean, that would make sense.
Okay. Thank you, Craig. Well, we'll stay on this story, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
Craig Pittman, reporter covering environmental issues for the Tampa Bay Times. And he has a forthcoming book, Oh Florida, coming out in July. We're going to take a break. When we come back, looking for another planet. There is a ninth planet out there, they think, not Pluto, not yet, but a different one, far, far away. We'll talk about the evidence for it. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Once upon a time, there were nine planets in our solar system, though some people claim that somewhere out there was a mysterious tenth planet, Planet X. In 2006, Pluto was demoted to dwarf planet status, a hotly contested move that left the solar system with eight official planets. But this week, researchers published their argument that somewhere out there is another large planet that we haven't seen yet, a Planet 9. Which is not the same as Pluto and not the same as the old Planet X. Confused? Well, I promise you this is not an old Ed Wood film. Here to sort out the planet stuff are two scientists making the case for Planet 9, Constantine Batygin and Mike Brown, both in the Division of Geological and Planetary Sciences at Caltech in Pasadena. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having us, Ira.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Tell us, what is the evidence that makes you think there's something out there?
Well, what we have found is really a gravitational signature of Planet 9. And that signature is seen in the most distant orbits of this debris field beyond the orbit of Neptune that we commonly refer to as the Kuiper Belt. If you look at the furthest orbits in this debris field, they all kind of swing out the same way. The only reasonable explanation for this confinement, this grouping of the orbits, is that there's a distant Planet 9, which is rather massive, keeping them together.
Or, as I like to say, we have felt a great disturbance in the force.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. That's good. Let me write that down.
Yeah.
How confident are you about this?
That's always the hardest question to answer. As a scientist, you try really hard not to believe yourself too much, because that's often where science goes wrong. And we spent a good year and a half out of the past 2 years not believing ourselves very much and actually trying very hard to prove that this idea was wrong and in fact crazy, because it always sounds crazy when you say there's another planet. But after the initial hints, we have been finding more and more signatures exactly where we predicted, and it's getting to the point where we believe it. We believe it enough that we're willing to write a paper and stand up and say, yes, for the past century, everybody who said there was a planet X is crazy, and they were all wrong, but we're right.
Hmm. Is it unusual to first see the evidence of a planet, not know where it is, not actually see it, and then find it? I mean, wasn't Uranus or some of the other planets found that way?
Exactly right. There's good historical precedent for this. In 1846, Neptune was discovered through a rather similar method. It was first predicted through a mathematical model, a rather complex one, which, as it's evidenced, used the irregularities in the Uranian orbit. So, you know, there's good historical, you know, context for this, and now the astronomical search for Planet Nine is on.
1-844-724-8255, 844-724-8255, if you'd like to get in on this. You can also tweet us. A tweet came in and already asks, is it inside or outside of the Kuiper Belt, and how far away is the planet?
So the Kuiper Belt, which of course is where Pluto is, it's where Eris, these other large objects, where the New Horizons spacecraft just went through. The Kuiper Belt is something like 4 to 5 billion miles away from the Sun. Planet Nine, at its closest approach to the Sun, is 20 billion miles away from the Sun, and it's on a very elliptical orbit. It goes all the way out to 100 billion miles away from the Sun. So Planet Nine is well outside of the Kuiper Belt, and we only see its effects on the sort of outer fringes of the Kuiper Belt, which is why it took us so long to realize that it was there.
So what kind of orbit would it have? How long would it take to go around the Sun once?
That orbit is somewhere between 10 and 20,000 years to go around the Sun. And it's tilted by about 30 degrees compared to all of the other planets in the solar system. So a very strange, elongated sort of orbit out there.
And how big is the object?
Well, our computer models estimate the object at right around 10 Earth masses. So this is a smaller brother, if you will, of Uranus and Neptune.
And is it a solid rocky one, or is it a gas one like Jupiter?
No, it's actually something in between. We believe that this object was created out of the same material that created Uranus and Neptune. So predominantly it's ice and rock, but probably about 10, at most 20% of its mass is comprised of hydrogen and helium in sort of this extensive atmospheric envelope.
And we say that just because that's actually a description also of Uranus and Neptune. So really what we're saying is we think it's like Uranus and Neptune.
What does it do to fulfill all those requirements we have now to be called a planet?
So there is the official lawyerly definition from the International Astronomical Union, which I hate the definition, but I love the concept that it's trying to describe. I just think it's a clunky statement of the concept. The concept it's trying to describe is that basically planets are the things that are the gravitationally dominant objects in their region of a planetary system. And, you know, anything that you're going to find by its gravitational influence is almost by definition part of that criterion. But really, if you actually went for the official lawyerly definition, it fits well within that, too. It's round, certainly it goes around the Sun. And the one that everybody has problems with is clears its orbit. There's now a mathematical description by an astronomer at UCLA, Jean-Luc Margot, which I think does a beautiful job of very precisely describing what that means. And this fits well within that criterion.
How do you know that something didn't happen a long time ago that threw all these objects into these orbits, a collision or something, but there's nothing there now?
So that's an excellent question. And in fact, one of the first experiments we did was to take the data, like take the observed orbits and leave them alone for a little while. If you come back in 500 million years, this alignment is gone. Right, so we can't outsource all of the interesting physics here to some event that happened, during the infancy of our solar system. Something is keeping the orbits grouped right now. On geologically short timescales, these orbits would become randomized if not for the gravitational pull of Planet Nine.
So basically, you're saying you see the debris and how it's all arranged in space. You say there must be a planet big enough to make them go into that arrangement, but we don't see it, and we don't know where it is.
We don't know where it is. Okay, sure. We don't know where it is. Maybe that's the right way to say it. But what we do know is we know its orbit. And what that means practically is that we know its path across the sky. So rather than have to look around the whole sky, which is a big place to look, we can actually look on a fairly narrow path of sky until we track it down. And in fact, we've even ruled out large portions of that track of sky already with some surveys that we've done. So we are. Our best guess is that Planet Nine is in the November sky. If you look up straight overhead at midnight on Thanksgiving Day, you're probably looking more or less in the direction of Planet Nine.
And so, what's the over under on getting a picture of the planet? Somebody actually seeing it and photographing it.
We're sort of in the stage of the project where we are beginning our observational search. This is definitely something that Mike is leading. This sort of requires the use of the largest telescopes in the world, particularly the Subaru telescope. We believe that we sort of predict that it's between 2 to 8 years as a reasonable time frame for detection.
Mm-hmm. There is a website which predicts these things, and it gives us odds. Do you know what the odds are on this?
Yeah, so there's a website called Metaculus, which gives us 2-to-1 odds that the planet will be discovered by the end of 2016.
Ooh, I might have to bet against that.
Wow. Okay, taking it to Vegas. 844-724-8255. Let's go to the phones to John in a very busy place this week, Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, John. John, are you there?
Hi, guys.
Hi there.
Hi, John.
I'm totally excited about this. I'm a complete layman, but I thought it would be an interesting way to look for the planet rather than optically, and I know that it's very dim and hard to see optically, would be to look for celestial objects behind it that are dimming as the planet passes in front of it.
So that's actually a great way that people have been finding, for example, planets around other stars these days. The bad
right.
news is that the probability of going in front of a star is minusculely small, and so we would have to get extremely lucky to do it. There are some interesting ideas, though, about using the background stars to look for gravitational deflections of the light as the light goes by Planet Nine, which I actually think is an intriguing idea that might have some possibility.
Yeah, people are thinking.
Thank you.
Yeah, good. Interesting idea. A tweet comes in, says, could this ninth planet, David O'Leary says, be a dwarf star or a body of dark matter?
So that's an intriguing question. I think the short answer is no. A dwarf star, we would have seen it. The WISE survey, which completed just about a couple of years ago, would have detected a dwarf star. In fact, that survey has ruled out the existence of dwarf stars in the solar system out to something like 20,000 astronomical units, maybe further out. Dark matter is very, very, very diffuse, right? So even the most clumpy parts of dark matter, which are hypothesized to exist, called caustics, are sort of the size of the solar system, and they usually amount to about an Earth mass. So it's unlikely that this planet is anything other than just a planet made up of regular matter.
Well, what made you guys decide to look for it? I mean, just say we're going to go look for a planet? I mean, what was
It all started out, for me, it started 20 years ago. When I started looking at the outer solar system, it was with the idea of finding a planet. And that was the survey that led to the discovery of all the objects that led to discovery to the demotion of Pluto. I like to say that Pluto was collateral damage on the way to trying to find this planet. But after the discovery, after the demotion of Pluto, I was pretty convinced there were no planets left to be found. And in fact, as my wife will tell you, I was moping around the house, depressed about the lack of planets in the outer solar system. And then 2 years ago, there was a beautiful paper by some of our colleagues, Chad Trujillo and Scott Shepard, who pointed out that there were some strange anomalies going on, gravitational anomalies in the outer solar system that really couldn't be explained. They suggested maybe there was a planet, but their suggestion, nobody could make a planet do the sorts of things that they were hoping it would do. So people mostly moved on and didn't think very much about it. But I know these guys, and I know that they knew what they were talking about. So we looked into it more carefully, mostly to prove that it couldn't be a planet, because that's crazy. Everybody knows there are no planets out there. And this led to our 2 years of trying to convince ourselves that it really wasn't a planet, and then realizing, yeah, it really is a planet.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's been the reaction of your colleagues? Is it skeptical or...?
So, you know, interestingly, mostly the reaction has been very positive, especially from our colleagues that have read the paper. They're more or less compelled by the arguments. There has been also a bit of skepticism, which we are very happy with. I think ideas like this should be met with a healthy dose of skepticism, and you know, hopefully this skepticism will lead some of our colleagues to confirm our calculations and arrive at the same answer. And you know, mm-hmm. ultimately, what we are hoping here is that this theoretical prediction of the orbit will trigger a hunt, an observational hunt for Planet Nine. That's the goal of this paper.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about this unseen planet, Planet Nine. So you have to hope that somebody will give you some scope time to go look for it, or somebody will decide.
Yeah. So the way astronomy works worldwide is you write a proposal for you time on a telescope. Committee reads it, gives you the time. I think we have a compelling proposal to write, so I'm confident that we'll be out at the telescope soon.
Mm-hmm. You've put out what you call a treasure map, breaking down where and what people should be looking for. Is this something that conceivably someone with a backyard telescope might see?
You know, it's funny. It actually, if it were at its closest approach to the sun at only 20 billion miles, it actually could be seen with the very largest backyard telescopes, not just your one that you got at the store for Christmas, but people with serious backyard observatories could see it. But because it would be so bright, I think we've ruled out that part of the sky. So we're pretty convinced it's at its most distant part of its orbit. And at its most distant, it really is going to require the biggest telescopes on the Earth.
And what name would you like? You know, that's the first thing. I know we talk about planets all the time. And we get more. I'm looking at the boards on my telephone here. What Vulcan, Sagan, what kind of name could we give Planet Nine?
So our working name for the time being, aside from Planet Nine, is George. You know, it's a perfectly good name. You know, I actually did this exercise earlier this morning where I looked at, you know, statistically the kind of average interval between the emails that I get asking to name the planet Bowie, which, you know, it must be, I must be getting coarse because that's starting to sound like a really good idea. But realistically, you know, this is the kind of question which should be left until this Planet Nine is caught on camera.
Mm-hmm. And when do you think, you said perhaps one of you thinks it's by the end of the year we might get a picture of it? And
I'm not so sure. That would make us, we would have to be pretty lucky. If we get it by the end of the year, it's probably because it actually is already in somebody's data, that they've taken images, didn't realize it was there, and now they see this and they go back and look. In fact, I have already heard from several different teams of astronomers who are frantically going through their old data right now. And you know, so who knows? We could hear about it tomorrow. That seems unlikely, but maybe by the end of the year. I have been saying that I think it will be found within 5 years. That seems like a reasonable outside time period. There are places in the sky that it could be that would make it harder than others, particularly if it's sitting right in front of the Milky Way galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy is big and bright and kind of makes it hard to see things. But if it's not there, it'll be found very easily. If it's there, it'll take us a little more effort.
Well, put us on your list for coming back, okay?
We'd be happy to.
Get a picture.
Absolutely.
Find out what it is, and we'll help you name the planet if you have any, because our listeners have absolutely no problem coming up with names.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're flooded with them yourself.
But, you know, it's good. It's good.
It's good for astronomy. Konstantin Batygin and Mike Brown, both in the Division of Geological Planetary Sciences at Caltech in Pasadena. Thank you, and happy hunting.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to follow our journey to the far reaches of space by boarding a ship here on Earth, a ship in the Indian Ocean that's trying to dig a hole, a really deep hole, into the crust of the Earth. They're about a half mile down and drilling. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. One of the first games you probably played in your backyard was how deep you could dig a hole, right? Start out, fling out dirt and rocks with your plastic shovel. And if you dig long enough, inevitably some wise guy is going to come by and say, "Have you reached China yet?" Well, my next guest has taken that hole digging challenge to a new level. He joins us aboard the research ship Joyous Resolution, way out in the middle of the Indian Ocean. The expedition has been drilling since December, trying to dig through to the crust of the Earth. Henry Dick is a geologist and co-chief scientist of that expedition on the boat there. Hopefully we can bring him in. Welcome to Science Friday. Henry.
Nice to be up talk to you, Ira.
How far have you gotten in this project? Yes, I can. How far have you gotten in the dig so far?
We're about a half mile down and drilling ahead. Unfortunately, we're going to be coming to an end of our cruise in about 10 days, so we're going to have to leave here and hope we come back soon.
And what is the point of all of this?
Well, there's several major points. The first of which is that the ocean crust comprises three-fifths of the Earth's crust, and yet in all that crust, most of it is lower crust, and we only have two holes into it, one in the Atlantic and one into the Indian Ocean, that are of any significance at all, and we haven't drilled more than about a third of the way through it. And, you know, when you're talking about the composition of three-fifths of the Earth's crust, that's kind of a big gap in our learning.
Mm-hmm. I remember back when I was a kid in the early 60s, there was something called Project Mohole.
There certainly was, and this is really an outgrowth of it. And one of the two guys who really dreamt up that is one of my heroes, Harry Hess. And he proposed that the MOHO, which is the first major seismic discontinuity beneath the crust, which many people think is the boundary between the crust and the mantle, he proposed that it was an alteration front. The mantle rising up in the oceans, for example, would undergo alteration with contact with seawater and produce rock of lower velocity. And they were actually looking at low-velocity rock lying on high-velocity rock, both of mantle origin. It fell out of favor, but since we've been working here in the Indian Ocean now for the last 15 years and up on the Gackle Ridge, we've discovered that large parts of the seafloor have no crust. The mantle is directly exposed from the seafloor. And that has revived the idea that we do have crust in these oceans, that the actual seismic discontinuity is an alteration front due to seawater sinking in through the crust and into the mantle.
Wow, that's cool. That's very interesting. Is there any possibility that way down, you're now a half mile and still drilling, there's life down there in the rocks?
Well, we've got a couple of biogeochemists on board who are busy assaying the rocks for microbes and fungi and other things, and they do find a few. But the hope is that if we have a lot of altered mantle rock down there, that creates hydrogen gas, which in turn reacts with seawater to form methane. And bugs can live off of methane, and we're thinking that there may be a hidden planetary biosphere beneath the Earth's crust out in the oceans.
You know, I know when I use my Craftsman drill bits at home, after a few drills through a piece of steel, the drill bit is basically wasted. How many drill bits do you go through so far?
We go through a drill bit every 40 hours. They cost about $16,000, and they are about 8 inches in diameter, and they have tungsten carbide roller cones on them that bang into the seafloor. You rotate it just like an oil drilling bit, except for it's hollow in the center, so we can pull up cores. And on top of that, we have about 75 tons of steel pipe.
Wow. Now, that brings up the point that oil drilling companies are always drilling holes in the ocean. How is your drilling different than what they do?
Well, they're out in sedimentary formations. They're looking for oil. And we're starting in basement rock on the lava, not in this case, on basement rocks from the lower crust. We actually are in a place where the shallowest layers were stripped off tectonically. And this is a huge advantage because the shallow layers are the hardest to drill through. And we're drilling right into a rock known as gabbro, which is the remains of mid-ocean ridge magma chambers.
And so how far do you think you can get before you have to come home?
We're thinking that we're going to get another 100 meters. So we'll be down about 850 meters. We think in meters, you know. And we will come back here hopefully in the next 2 years, if not then in the next 4 or 5 years, for another leg where we hope to drill an additional mile. We've got the hole set up, which is quite a trick, you have to set up a drill cone so you can get back in the hole and drill it into the hard rock, and then you bore on down, and it's going to take at least two of these expeditions and possibly three to get through the crust and into the mantle.
So you're not afraid that the rock is going to shift a little bit and close the hole up or make it impossible to go back down through that same spot?
I'm very sorry. We had an interruption here. Could you repeat that?
Yeah. You're not fearful that when you give up on this hole and go home, that it might not close up or the Earth's crust or the rock might not shift and close, make it more difficult to get back?
Well, that's an interesting question because we moved the hole from where our test hole was, and we ran into immediately worse conditions. And the reason we moved it is we wanted to see how the crust varies. And we ran right into a fault zone, and that slowed us down. And so there is an area at the top of the hole with a lot of loose rock, and we lost a bit of a drill bit in it, which then fell down later on, deeper in the hole, and we found ourselves drilling on top of it so we'd get no core. And this is one of the problems with hard rock drilling is it's very risky.
Yeah.
And so what we're going to do is we're going to actually pump some cement into the top of the hole where that interval was. It'll go into the formation and lock it up. And we come back here, it'll be pretty easy to drill through that cement and continue drilling on down.
Well, we wish you luck, Henry, and safe travels and good luck in finishing your project.
Well, thank you.
Henry Dick is a geologist.
You're excited.
Yeah. Henry Dick is a geologist based out of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute there on the boat in the Indian Ocean. Last spring, a book arrived at her office. It was one of the new autobiographies from Oliver Sacks, his autobiography, you know, the famed neurologist and author. Except the guy in the cover did not look like the Oliver Sacks that we all knew. This guy was wearing laced-up leathers, you know, bicycle, motorcycle leathers. He was sitting on top of a giant BMW motorcycle, a motorcycle he looked strong enough to lift off the ground. That man, of course, Oliver Sacks, that was him in 1961. We just didn't know about Dr. Sacks' love for motorcycle racing or about a lot of other stuff, it turns out, that he has written about in his autobiography. And so this winter, the Sci-Fi Book Club is reading. We're assigning that as our book club, his autobiography, Oliver Sacks is On the Move. And we want you to join in that book club. And here to explain how you can is our Sci-Fi Arts producer, Anne Minoff. Hi, Annie. Welcome to Sci-Fi.
Well, thank you for having me, Ira.
Tell us about this book that we're choosing in the club.
On the Move, well, I think, as you mentioned, that picture is, like, really the only introduction you need. This is Oliver Sacks sitting atop his BMW hog. And really, this is kind of the other Oliver Sacks, the one, you know, who's always kind of flitting around the edges of those, you know, more scientific works, but who we really get to know in this book. And in fact, I'll explain a little bit about our club, of course, for the newbies. What happens is we give you 3 weeks to read this book, On the Move. And then we're going to be joined back here in the studio on February 12th to talk about it with two very special guest readers. And I'll tell you about the first of those readers, Maria Popova, who, of course, you know very well. She comes on the show very frequently to talk about some of her favorite science books. And I should say that Maria has really tipped her hand on this one because she has been on our program not once but twice in the past year to talk about how much she loves On the Move, as she does in this clip from when she was on our show back in July.
This book is not an autobiography in the strict sense. It's more of a dialogue with time on several simultaneous scales. There's the personal. We see him going from a world champion weightlifter to world-renowned neurologist. The cultural. He's a young gay man looking for love in the 1960s, very different than our post-DOMA world. And even the civilizational. He's standing on the beach at City Island watching horseshoe crabs mate exactly as they did 400 million years ago on Earth's primordial seas. And I have to say, I don't say this lightly because I read a lot of books, dozens a month, but this has been one of the most profound reading experiences of my life.
So a great introduction to On the Move from Maria Popova. And we'll also be joined in our discussion of this book by Dr. Danielle Ofri. And she is a physician and writer based at Bellevue Hospital here in Manhattan. She's also the editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review, which is a literary review run by and for doctors. So I'm very interested to hear what she will make of On the Move.
And we have some free books to give away,
absolutely.
Right?
Every time we do this club, we love to partner with Powell's Books. Our friends there have donated 20 brand spanking new copies of On the Move hardcover, I should say. And we would like you, if you're listening, to have a chance to win one of these and have them shipped to you for free. And the way that you can enter to win one of those books from Powell's is by going to our website, sciencefriday.com. You'll see a big blue banner. Click on that. Fill out the form. That form is going to close at 10 p.m. tonight, so don't put it off. We're going to be picking those winners at random, sending them a free book. And if you don't win, Powell's has the book on sale. So
I'll give you a discount.
Exactly.
Yeah, Powell will give you a discount. You've waded through the book? You're reading through
Absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, I have.
It is so many, it's so surprising stuff in there.
It really is. And, you know, kind of the surprise that many people have spoken about is just how candidly he writes about growing up as a young gay man in London in the 50s, then in the U.S. in the 60s, at a time when, you know, in Britain at least, it wasn't just kind of socially looked down upon to be gay, but it was actually illegal. So he writes very movingly.
Like Alan Turing. He was arrested.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he writes about Alan Turing and kind of what he went through. So that's, of course, very moving. For me, one of the big surprises was to learn that this man who we always knew as Dr. Sacks also went by Dr. Squat on the weightlifting platforms on Muscle Beach, California. He was a massive and very successful amateur weightlifter.
600-pound record.
600-pound California state squat record. And you can see a picture of this on our website. It's absolutely amazing.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Annie Minoff about our book club. I'll tell you, I knew him for 25 years, and the first time I met him, I was so surprised. You know, I knew his reputation, and I stood next to him on a podium, and I'm just looking at his upper body, and he's, you know, he's a man who's in his 50s or 60s by then, but he's still bulked up. So I said, who is this guy? You know, he must have been a weightlifter, ha, 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 some time ago, and sure enough, he was.
It's true, yes. For me, one of the great joys of this book has been getting to know Oliver Sacks as a writer. And he was a prolific, as we know, a prolific writer, not just of books, but, you know, he estimates he wrote probably 1,000 clinical notes in a year. And he did this for decades. You know, whenever he traveled, he would take a journal, whether he was hitchhiking across America with his trucker friends, Mac and Howard, in the 1960s or in Oaxaca looking for rare ferns. He would always, you know, take notes. And we really get the benefit of that in this book. And you really get a sense of the joy that he found in writing. So here's Oliver Sacks actually reading from On the Move.
The act of writing, when it goes well, gives me a pleasure, a joy, unlike any other. in these rare heavenly states of mind, I may write nonstop until I can no longer see the paper. Only then do I realize that evening has come and that I've been writing all day.
You know, something I have to point out also about Oliver Sacks is he's the only person I've ever heard of who wrote in the swimming pool.
Underwater?
Not underwater, but he was a very avid swimmer, and he writes in the book about how whole sentences and whole paragraphs would come to him while he was swimming. And so he would take a notepad to the pool and kind of, you know, mm-hmm. get up on the platform and just take some very soggy notes by the side of the pool.
And just hearing his voice, it's still too soon for me.
Well, one of the reasons we wanted to read one of his books is, you know, when he passed away late last summer, we did a tribute to him, of course, on the show, celebrating his life. But we also wanted to celebrate this amazing literary legacy that he has left us. I mean, 14 amazing books. So we actually put it up to a vote. We asked you know, our listeners, what would you like to read from Dr. Oliver Sacks? And it was a squeaker. It was real close. There are a lot of musicophilia fans out there, I must say.
And we're going to have an event in the New York City area, right?
That's right. So in addition, of course, to joining us on air when we wrap up our book club, if you do live in the New York City area, you can meet up with us at the New York Botanical Garden, a very special place for Dr. Sacks. We're going to be talking about the book with Dr. Danielle Ofri and Maria Popova. We're going to get a tour of the ferns and cycads that Dr. Sacks loved, and you can join us for that. It's free on February 6th, and to sign up, go to sciencefriday.com/meetup.
And when do we meet up again for the book club?
February 12th, so you can mark your calendars, you know, take some notes as you're reading, call in, tell us what you thought, and of course, keep the discussion going over these 3 weeks. We're using the hashtag SciFry Book Club.
And we have those free books, a couple of dozen free books we're giving away.
That's right. Big blue banner on our website, sciencefriday.com.
Get a 30% discount on the book if you can't get in on that. Thank you, Annie.
Absolutely.
Annie Minoff is SciFry's SciArts producer, and you can learn more about the book club and enter, as I say, to win a free book at sciencefriday.com. One last thing. I'm sorry to bring the bad news, but Spider-Man would be too heavy in real life to be able to stick to walls. Cambridge University scientists calculate that he would have to have size 114 boots and 43-inch hands to provide enough stick-em power to hold his weight. He ain't no gecko, but then again, how many scientists have been bitten by a radioactive spider? Think about it. Yeah. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Ntaliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And if you missed any part of the program you'd like to share with somebody else, point your tablet, your smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com. where you can also join our mailing list. And again, a reminder that you can get in on our book club and find out all about the book there that we're reading. And if you like us on Facebook. You just go to the web, Facebook site and then like us there. And we're on all week long on a discussion on Twitter at SciFry. And you can download our iPhone and Android apps and listen and look on demand. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.